and the boat tears through it, making a division, separate, parting the waters, plowing through it. And then if you run to the rear deck and watch, there is a wake behind it, just behind it, commotion, terrible commotion. The water is churning. And then if you look a little further ahead behind you, what was parted is brought back again. That's exactly what happens in bhakti. Then again it's possible to see another simple comparison with when you are still thinking of the boat. This bhakti is more like a pleasure cruise. What do you do when you go out, when you go on a pleasure cruise? You start from, let's say, Vancouver. You go to Hawaii and Japan and Australia and New Zealand, and then come back to Vancouver. If you stood on the deck on your return in Vancouver, if I had to come back here, why did I leave this place at all? That is what's called pleasure, isn't it? You want to enjoy yourself, and in order to enjoy yourself, you leave the place, go around and come back to the same place. That is what God is doing all the time. The moment you apply your brain, your mind, your intellect to it, your rational mind, your logical mind to it, the whole thing sounds absurd. And so will everything sound absurd in life. Why must I put food into this mouth when I know that it is going to disintegrate? It's ridiculous. This may not be a very decent joke, but please treat it just as a joke. No one pours milk into just a tube. You pour milk into the glass because you know one side is open, the other side is closed. If I hold a tube in front of you, you wouldn't care to pour some milk into it. But yet you are doing it all the time. So if the intellect is brought into it, it's a disaster. So it must be understood heart to heart. That's it. Bhakti first creates a division. In the one God, it seems to create a division. Bhakti means, oh, you're not here day for yesterday. Bhakti means division as well as devotion. Division as well as devotion. Devotion meaning oneness, division meaning two-ness. So it creates a division first in order to bring the two together. A diversity is created first in the one, and later the diversity is harmonized and blended into one. Why should one be divided into a diversity? We don't know. Instead of saying we don't know, we call it all sorts of things. And eventually, the only reasonable, emotionally reasonable, explanation that I've heard is that it is the divine play. The Christians call it divine mystery, the Hindus call it divine play, Leela. Maya is the Vedanti business. Yeah, right, thank you. We might just as well mention that. So that here again you will find a paradoxical in the sense that this cannot be taught. This cannot be really communicated. One has to catch it within oneself. While we are told that all this is God, must eventually regard, see God in everything, yet in the right until the penultimate stage, there is a constant division. chop this. What your heart does not accept as God now must be ruthlessly avoided. Maya. In bhakti, they really don't call it Maya. The Maya business comes in jnana, when it comes to atma, anatma, and that sort of thing. In bhakti, it's almost like Satan. It's almost like, you know, this is something bad, evil. This must be avoided. Evil company must be avoided.
It's a more emotional response.
I don't know. Now let me... I think you people are in the majority, so it's better not to... Never mind, it's there in the Bhakti Sutra. It's there in the book. Stri dhana nastika kathanam na shravaniyam. One should never listen to these three. Stories concerning these three. News or stories concerning these three. Women. wealth. And atheistic doctrines. One should avoid all this. Like plague. So that, whereas on the one hand I am being told that God is omnipresent. And you must realize this is omnipresent God. I am at the same time told, keep away from this, keep away from that, keep away from that. In other words, first I must see the mind works on the basis of division. The mind creates this division. And while the mind creates this division, it is bound to create the division into what I like and what I do not like. The mind divides everything into these two groups, what I like and what I do not like. And since it is the mind that is the divider, unless I abolish this function of the mind, the unity is not possible. If you tread cautiously here, you might see it. The mind divides everything. And unless that function of the mind is stopped, the union is not possible. Then I look at the same thing again. What does the mind divide things into? I like this, I don't like this. So by some magic, I must make this likable and that unlikable. Equalizing. It's not really equalizing, perhaps. It creates other problems. What the mind likes, I must make it dislike. I must say it's Maya, it's danger, it's Satan. And what the mind dislikes, I must see something good in it and make the mind do it. When thus both these things are cancelled, when the division between like, I like and I don't like is cancelled, then I have arrived at the no-mind stage. When there is no mind, there is enlightenment. Why all this complication? Why not? There is no why not. So one should bear in mind throughout these discussions that there is this complicated contradiction. Complicated because superficially it looks like contradiction, but if you go underneath, understand with the heart, you might discover that it is really not contradiction. It is something inherent in nature which I have to discover. A contradiction which is really complementary. A contradiction which is in fact and truth complementary. Contradiction on the superficial level, complementary deeper down. So, this bhakti is what recognizes an existent division and a potential oneness at the same time. An existent division between you and me, an existent division between me and the cosmos and the cosmic being, and a potential oneness. That cosmic being is temporarily known as God. Why should we call it God? You got to use some word, use any word you like, doesn't matter. And when no word matters, why not use the word God? It doesn't matter either. It doesn't matter you what word you use. So why not use the word God? That's important to remember, because it is not the word that we are worshipping. It is not the word that we want to become one with. It is the truth which the word seems to represent. Seems to represent because the mind sees it as representing the other. The word does not represent God. G-O-D does not represent God. Om does not represent God. But the mind, associating this with that, seems to link this word with God. G-O-D with God. Otherwise, if you are playing with these plastic words, you can make all sorts of monstrous things with the word God. Dog. It means nothing. And also, it is important in bhakti, which is an affair of the heart, that the word or the symbol or whatever, or the door that is used to get beyond this division to the realm of union, that door must attract us, not repel us. One should like, one should feel attracted to it. This is a sutra in Patanjali's. Yata abhimata dhyanadva. You meditate upon anything you like. You can choose your own object of meditation, an object which you like. If you do not like it, you are put off right from the beginning, and then the mind doesn't want to think of it at all. And Krishna echoes that teaching in the Gita. Yo yo vyamyam tanum bhakta shraddhya achyutum icchati. Whatever be the form that the devotee wants to, loves to worship, that he can choose. There's total freedom here, absolutely total freedom. But there must be, one must understand this, I must love, the mind must, the heart must naturally flow towards that object of devotion. Otherwise, there is trouble. Incidentally, both these lovely names you have heard again and again and again, Rama and Krishna, both mean exactly the same thing. Rama, the word, means that which delights the heart, in which the heart loves to rest, in which your heart and your soul love to rest, which makes you happy. Krishna, again, means that which attracts you powerfully, in spite of yourself. Again, I think today's day of contradictions. Let me point out that also there is a lovely contradiction in that word, Krishna. Krishna means that which attracts you. And Krishna also means that which rubs you, like a rough-hewn stone on which you are rubbed and so that you are cleaned. That may not be very pleasant. On the one hand, there is the pleasant and the beauty that attracts you, enslaves you, sort of, you know. And on the other, rubs you, chastens you. So both these things are there together, that name Krishna. But what we are concerned here now is the attraction. The object that the devotee chooses must be something which attracts his heart, and his attention. But otherwise, one can choose any object one likes. What is the fun here? The fun is, there is a basic recognition already that this God or this cosmic being or cosmic consciousness is omnipresent, so that it can be reached anywhere through anything. Cosmic consciousness being present everywhere can be reached anywhere in any form. One more contradiction. Then why should I sit and gaze at a little statue of Krishna, Buddha, or whatever it is, and worship it and adore it? And, we are not necessarily compelled to close our eyes. Close my eyes and contemplate, intensely fix my attention upon this form and meditate upon Krishna or Buddha or Christ. In that intense concentration or meditation, you enter into the very heart of the object you contemplate. Pierce it, as it were, so that you go on negating, not this, not this, not this, and enter into the right, into the core of it. And there it explodes and reveals the Divine Presence. Didn't you say that God is omnipresent? Why must I go on poking into this one single cell? That which is everywhere is present here. And so, in order to experience the omnipresence, you pierce right down to the indwelling presence and see it there. When you see it there, you see it everywhere. When you see the truth that exists in the minutest atom of existence, you at the same time see the truth that is cosmic. Again, though superficially these two appear to be contradictory, they are really complementary. We are talking about the same thing. And there again, I like to adore a certain thing, a certain object. This is Krishna. This is what I like most. This is the form I like most. So I am allowed to contemplate on that thing. Now we come to another risky step. Let's say the statue or whatever it is made of. In South India there are quite a number of statues made of what they call the five metals. Five noble metals: gold, silver, copper, iron, one more, forgotten, brass, I don't know. Brass is the same as copper, is it? No, different. Right. So, probably lead and copper or brass, isn't it? Something. Anyhow, panchaloha, five metals. Now, it's possible for you to deck that image as you like, to help your concentration. Then you are warned, you are worshipping God, not the statue. So don't get hung up on that. So that if somebody steals that statue for the worth of the metal in it, you shouldn't go into mourning. God doesn't die. Again, there's this thing, division and cohesion. I can choose to worship anything I like, but for the sake of God, for God, not for this person. And even so, I can worship a person, a tree, anything. What do we worship? What do we adore? God. How do we distinguish God from what? Why is that God different from me? What is this me? Why is this me so base? Because it is egotistic. And why do I worship that statue? Because it has no ego. It's so simple. Why do I worship a statue? Because the statue has no ego at all. Once again, we are coming back to our theory of evolution, yes? Huh? Right. That is not stated so in Bhakti Yoga, but it's my inference. And so, you start from the human level, but eventually you must come round. The spiral expands, and here it is not so much a spiral as concentric circles. If you throw a stone in the swimming pool, it gives rise to concentric circles. The vision should expand and expand and expand and expand without getting lost. The vision should expand in concentric circles without ever getting lost. And therefore there is this caution all the time. Let the vision expand but don't get lost. Let the vision expand but don't get lost. If you understand this principle clearly, then you find that she said that karma yoga sounds very difficult. Bhakti yoga is equally difficult, even though it is usual in the holy circles in India to regard bhakti yoga as easy. It's also difficult. The consciousness must expand in concentric circles without ever getting lost. How does that happen? The procedure is given in the 10th chapter of the Gita. As you go on, as your consciousness begins to expand, watch your step very carefully and realize the presence of God in what the mind does not doubt. Ask yourself, what is it that appeals to me as divine without any ray of doubt, a shadow of doubt? Start from there. Then let the understanding or the consciousness expand in concentric circles, including a little more, expanding a little more. But don't get lost. In other words, don't say that this is divine and all else is undivine. Don't say that. Don't say that my Krishna, this statue alone is God, all the rest is nonsense. Then you are lost. You are stuck and you are lost. Without getting lost, can the consciousness expand in concentric circles, gently, slowly? First you see God in some, in your temple, in your church. There, your mind somehow does not doubt it at all. Take for instance, a cross or crucifix or even a picture of Krishna or Buddha. The mind has been conditioned to accept it already as something divine. So that even if you are a real atheist, you would still not trample upon a crucifix. I think you watch. You may do it just to say, oh, I don't care. But somewhere deep within you there is something says no, better not. Maybe there is a hell, maybe there is something else. Huh? Maybe I will be punished. There is a ray of doubt. This is what I want to suggest. So here, there is no doubt at all. The mind readily accepts, the heart readily accepts it as something divine. Take it. It may be different for different people. It may be a statue for some, a scripture for some others, or a flower for somebody else. That is not universal. Each one starts at a different point. And start from your own point. Don't accept somebody else's starting point. You'll fail. You are somewhere. Look within and see, what is it that inspires my heart? What is it that uplifts and elevates my heart? Whereas there is the sacred cow, the holy cow in India. There is a holy camel in Arabia. There is a holy dog in New York. Yeah? Somewhere something is holy. So start from where you want to start. Don't jump on somebody else's shoulders. That's useless. What does my mind accept without question, without doubt, as something holy? Right. Now, whenever I look at that, I'm reminded of something superhuman. Something out of this world. Then you go from there, take one round, a little more. All the things that are also connected with it. There are quite a number of objects connected with it. You include them also into this. For instance, you have learned to admire a lily, a lotus. And you, whenever you see that lotus, you are thrilled. You see God in that. Then you begin to see, then you suddenly begin to notice the other wild flowers, and you look at them, they are also as beautiful as the lotus. The consciousness is slowly expanding a little more, a little bit more. And then you see some nice faces, this also looks like lotus. This is another type of flower. And you learn to see God in these, gradually, slowly expanding. You see a church, if you are a very religious person, you see a church and you cross yourself, bow down. Then you go somewhere else, you see a synagogue, you see a mosque or a temple or something else. What the church is to me, this is to the other person. Right? Whatever the church is to me, this is to the other person. I learn to see God, the presence of God there. Gradually, slowly it expands. Till I begin to see, my God, this girl has got two temples too. I see the temple there, I see the temple in the church, I see the temple in the mosque, I see the temple in the synagogue, and I see the temple on the sides of her face. Gradually, as the feeling unfolds. So, slowly the circle expands and expands and expands, and to begin with, the heart associates divine with something which is pure. Means, there is something which is impure, which has to be rejected. Even here the mind functions and the mind goes in front. like the ship. The mind plows through all this and it says, this is very beautiful, this is really divine. This is really divine. That, no, ugly. Right, keep it there. There's no struggle in all this. If you think that only this is divine, that is not divine, keep it there. With what is not divine, you have no business. Leave it alone. You don't have to go kicking it. There's a beautiful saying in Tamil. If you hit filth with a rock, it'll come back to you. Your own face and your own clothes will be soiled. Leave it alone. Leave that alone. Your mind doesn't want to accept it as divine, leave it alone. This is divine, go on with it. Why waste your time in all that? Go on with this. And as you go on with this thing, it is possible that the concentric circle keeps expanding. And then you come round, you learn to look at that, and you learn to look at this, you learn to look at what is divine, you learn to look at what you previously considered as undivine, and see something good in it, something nice in it. Slowly you add one portion of it to this divine. I still think that something funny, but you know, she's still a good girl, that sort of thing. Her behavior is not all that correct, but no, she's a good girl, never mind. Add a little bit of it to this divine. And turn round, it comes a little more, and then you find, my God, she's marvelous. Yeah. The whole thing is coming. Then you are ready to say that everything